In a small village in northern France 100 years ago, the summer of 1918, the U.S. was taking its first steps onto the world stage.
Old Hindenburg will know he has no chance when Alexander takes his ragtime band to France.
100 years ago, around this time, America was entering the world stage by joining World War I. The Battle of Belleau Wood, which was the birth story of the modern American Marine Corps, but certainly recognition that American military might would matter.
Peter Fever is a public policy professor at Duke University, director of the Duke Program in American Grand Strategy, and a member of the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration.
For a decade or two, for about 20 years, America did not wield the global leadership commensurate with its potential power. Until World War II and Operation Torch, the landing on North Africa, followed by, of course, D-Day, that was the hinge of the century. After that point, America shouldered the leadership role, replaced Great Britain as the leader of the free world, and has never handed the mantle off politically, economically, and also psychological power, cultural power, the recognition that America was the future, and if you wanted to be on the right side of the future, you wanted to be on the path that America was on.
But in 2018, American leadership no longer looks as bright. According to Gallup, the average trust in institutions like the presidency, public schools, the Supreme Court, and organized religion is just 33%. Congress, well, it falls somewhere around 11%, which, by the way, is just over what the Emoji movie scored on Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah, it's that bad.
This is the question of 2018. Will American leadership endure?
This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter, and this hour, we'll be exploring that question. Will American leadership endure?
It is so much easier to get your arms around the question, who decides, on a question that is about your neighborhood library branch, than what is going to happen with immigration reform in the U.S. Senate.
The numbers of people who are being exonerated from death row, that is one of the most salient examples of the degree of change that can happen.
I would like to think that because there's such a vacuum of ideas in the party right now, somebody with political ambition will try to fill that vacuum.
I see all these media outlets, and I know nothing about these. I don't know who's working there. I don't know who's running it. I think it's gotten incredibly confusing for the consumer.
The institution Americans most trust, perhaps not surprisingly, is the military. So let's start there. Here's Peter Fever from Duke University again. I asked him, will Americans' faith in the military last?
Well, there's reason to think that it may not last indefinitely. The military focuses on this number closely. They worry about it. But why might it not last? Well, for starters, if you disaggregate, you realize it's a super high level of confidence among Republicans and just a moderate high among Democrats. So the average number is in the 60s or high 50s. But it's propped up by Republican numbers in the 90s and Democratic numbers in the low 50s. Also, we do see a demographic or generational shift. That is to say, the younger people have less confidence than older people. They also have less personal connections, ties, family members, immediate family members. It's their grandparents who served, not their parents. So all these reasons might point downward, but there's one more that I'll flag for you. When I started in this business 20, 30 years ago, and I'd talk about it, I'd say there's two institutions that the public has a high degree of confidence, the military and the Supreme Court. I no longer have to say that, right? The public confidence in the Supreme Court has plummeted. Why? There's several reasons, but one reigning theory is that the public came to look at the Supreme Court as a partisan institution. And the institutions that the public dislikes tends to be the ones that are perceived to be partisan. Congress, obviously a partisan institution. The media, perceived to be partisan. The danger is if the military comes to be seen as partisan, if it gets too closely associated with one party, most likely the Republican Party, will that cause people to look at the military through a partisan lens? If so, that could cause public confidence to drop.
Okay, let's step back now to
another question of trust and leadership, which is America's role in the world. Is America the leader of the international order?
Yes. As if you took a snapshot in 2018, you would say yes. In fact, if you look at the last 100 years, that's the defining geopolitical fact of the last century. This is the question of 2018. Will American leadership endure? And if I were to summarize the questions for America, I would say, first, do Americans understand the price of freedom? Secondly, do they understand the benefits of global leadership? Thirdly, do our allies trust us and respect us enough to shoulder their load? Fourth, do our adversaries fear us and don't want to cross us? And then fifth, does our government work? And those five questions are up for grabs in a way that they haven't been in our professional lifetime.
Though this didn't just start in 2018, and it probably didn't just start in 2016 with the election either. So where do you begin to analyze where this question about American leadership in the world?
Well, the Europeans would begin it right after the end of World War II, or actually in the middle of World War II. They said they had grave doubts about the quality of American leadership. And if you go back, the things that we're arguing about today, are the Europeans carrying their load on the one hand? Is America behaving recklessly like a cowboy? That's what we argued about at the founding of the Transatlantic Alliance. Indeed, that's the reason for NATO, was to corral the Europeans into carrying their load. And from the European point of view, tie the Americans in so they don't do something reckless like they did in 1919. So what's different now? What's different now is all of those arguments have more merit today than they did before. So German shirking on the defense budget is greater today than it's ever been. So President Trump is absolutely right when he calls out the Europeans that they could be doing more, should be doing more. They need to do more. He's right about that. At the same time, European complaints about the way America's conducting diplomacy in the last 2 years, those have more merit today than in previous times. It's kind of quaint to think about the complaints that were they leveled against Obama or Bush, you know, Bush the cowboy, in comparison to perhaps how President Trump handled the G7 summit. I think they were probably wishing that it was President Bush the cowboy back this time around. So the complaints have more merit now.
I want to go back to, I can't remember if it was one, two, or three of your important points to think about going forward. One of those was that Americans understand the price of freedom.
Right.
Is that really the core issue here, that unless or until Americans have a relationship with what it means to have America in this role, the faith in it is never going to be able to come back, and the leadership will never be able to rise.
Right. I do think that American self-confidence is crucial. In the 30s, we shifted to what academics call offshore balancing. We'll stay offshore and let the problems on the continent manage themselves. But then we had to fight our way onshore, literally fight our way onshore on D-Day, in order to stabilize a broken balance of power system. And the Americans learned at that moment that we can't afford to fight our way back on shore. We need to stay on shore. Yes, that means deploying troops on an indefinite basis in far-flung places, but the price is lower in peace maintaining than in trying to win the peace again. And so that was a lesson that lasted for 70 years. What you're seeing now is some elites, but most dramatically, the president himself, ask the question, is it still worth it? Do we still need to do that? And when the president's asking that question, then it's so much louder than if it's just a New York Times op-ed that's asking the question. And so that, I think, contributes to the sense of doubt about American commitment to global leadership.
When you think about a global leadership problem, is it really the issue of domestic political leadership problems?
I think so. If you go back 120 years, and you say, what did the future look like? You saw one country, the United States, that had access to cheap energy, that was at the forefront of the manufacturing industrial revolution, and because of immigration, could do a brain drain to get the best and most industrious entrepreneurial people of the world to come here and build their lives here. And because of that combination, America vaulted past the other countries that couldn't compete on those dimensions. Fast forward to today, America has access to cheap energy. America is at the cutting edge of the new manufacturing revolution. And we're still the most attractive place for immigration. Still the world's best and brightest want to come to America and would like to build their future in America if they could. We haven't fixed that problem. We've made it hard for them to do so, but that's for domestic reasons, not for structural reasons, say the way the Japanese are struggling with this, or even the Chinese are struggling with this. So those three pillars, or the three legs of the stool on which we stood in the 20th century, are available to us now. So the next 100 years could be our century as well, if we solve the domestic political functioning problem.
Does the next leader need to be somebody that's coming from politics, meaning that the person that's really going to set the stage for us thinking about who America is, America's role in the world? Does it always have to be the president, or could this come from somewhere else?
Well, one of the challenges we're seeing in 2018 is that our leaders from other prominent institutions, let's say tech, big tech, which were kind of the darlings of the last decade, they've stumbled and gotten their shoes dirty. And so I think people doubt big tech today in a way that they might not have a decade ago. Traditional corporate America doesn't look good. The financial institutions, I think the public is still skeptical about them because of the Great Recession. And the institution that's held in high esteem is the one we don't want to come to the rescue, and that's the military. So the public still has confidence in the military, but we do not need, we do not want the military to come rescue us from this political crisis.
Are you worried at all that we could be in that situation at some point?
I don't worry that the military has that impulse.
No,
I do worry that that desperate civilians might ask the military to do that in some way. And indeed, that's one of the things we've seen, that President Trump has reached out to senior military officers, active and retired, to fill jobs that in previous administrations were filled by civilians. But the pattern of asking the military to rescue us from non-military threats, that's not a good pattern for us to get into. So if you say, who do I look for to help us solve our political problems? It's our politicians. I want our political leaders to step up.
Peter Feaver is the director of the Duke Program in American Grand Strategy. And I want to emphasize his last point, that while Americans respect and admire the military, we do not want military leaders to save us from our current political crisis. That's not the American political model. We need political leaders, as Peter emphasizes, to be better at their jobs.